some of the stars through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Rated G Radio. We've got a great show tonight. I've got Mr. Dirk Sayers joining us as our VIP special guest star tonight. He's the author of a new book called West of Tomorrow. We're going to be talking to him about his writing journey, as well as the book, and how he got to be where he's at today. He's a fascinating gentleman, and I'm honored and privileged to have such a talented author on the show. We'll be bringing him on in just a couple of moments. Want to send a big shout-out to Lisa Peeney. We had her scheduled yesterday, but she had a health scare of sorts, so we're going to ask everybody just to keep her in thoughts and prayers for a speedy recovery and well wishes. But she promises she'll be back next month, and so we'll look forward to seeing Lisa then. Monday, we had Mr. John Gardner. He is a professional wrestling manager with cerebral palsy and spinal stenosis. I bet you didn't know that was possible and to be in professional wrestling, but it's true, and he shared his story with us on Monday. He's looking to venture into the world of motivational speaking, and so he shared with us a little bit about what he's looking to accomplish and the lives he's hoping to change this year. So Monday was John Gardner. Go check that out. Tomorrow, it's our regular Thursday feature called Rated LGBT Radio with my co-host, Mr. Rob Watson. We will be joined with our guest star tomorrow night of Terrence Moss. He is a writer, producer, and director. He's currently working on the fourth season of a popular web series called Child of the 70s, and Terrence will tell us all the dirt that's going on behind the scenes. That is tomorrow night with Rated LGBT Radio with Mr. Rob Watson. And then on Friday, we have Kafir, K-F-I-R, Kafir, live from New York City. He is a former star of Broadway's Phantom of the Opera, and he has left that choice role to pursue his career in music full-time. He's been on the show every year we've been on the air, but he's coming back to tell us some new projects that he's working on this Friday with a special start time of 3 p.m. I cannot wait for that. Now, before I bring Dirk on, I want to give a couple of mad shout-outs today to people who have been pinging me all day. Victoria Jibo, I want to say thank you for a referral that came my way, but also to Mr. Scott Travis, the dashing gentleman who makes these amazing all-natural candles. We were out on a photo shoot today in the Playa del Rey area of beautiful southern sunny California, and I can't wait to see what he plans to do with the pictures that we took. But we're going to see some exciting things from CBT Candle. I can't wait to share more information with you in the very near future, and that will be exciting for all of you, I promise. Now, tonight, our author, I would say, you know, let me read you his bio, but you see it right there on the show page, so I'm not going to insult you by reading to you because it's right there for you to check out. But this author, Mr. Dirk Sayers, was introduced to me by Maddie Margarita, who is part of SCWA, and she also hosts a fantastic writers group down in Irvine called Lit Up, and she connected the dots. So the 6 degrees of separation to Kevin Bacon is Maddie right here to the show with Mr. Dirk Sayers, who is my privilege and honor to have as a guest tonight. So, Dirk, our first time really visiting together, and welcome to Rated G Radio. How are you tonight?
I'm good. Thanks so much, Garrett. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, my gosh. This will be fun. I always love talking to authors for the first time. I love having you back the second and third time, so I will encourage you to write more. But the first time I have you on the show, because this is usually the first time our listeners have a chance to hear about you, I always like to just say, you know, where did it all start? Where did you grow up? Tell us a little bit about your background and how you became the great man you are today.
Yes, everybody's favorite job interview question. Tell me about yourself.
Right.
I kind of grew up in the Midwest. No, I didn't kind of grow up there. I actually did, kind of 1 foot in the rural heartland, if you will. But interestingly enough, the other in a liberal university town, because that's where I lived. But there was literally farm country right out my front door. So you kind of got the chance of dealing with the really conservative element of the society. And then you go on campus, and, of course, everybody was protesting the war in Vietnam. So I had my earliest experiences dealing with trying to hold two conflicting views in my head at the same time. grew up swimming competitively and was just successful enough to get a scholarship to bankroll my education that way, supplemented a bit with jobs here and there while I wasn't studying. And after I graduated, I was commissioned a Marine officer and spent the next 22 and a half years in uniform, Asia, Africa, Middle East, Europe, the usual suspects. Retired in 94 as a lieutenant colonel right after Somalia and took an 18-month sabbatical to get a master's in organizational management and development. And shortly thereafter, was hired by a local manufacturer retailer in Orange County and spent my next years as a corporate trainer and district manager. What all that had to do with writing was almost nowhere I went was I not involved in writing and writing extensively.
I thought I heard a couple of clicks, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I lost you. Okay. Okay, good. So I got a question for you. So after you went to college as a competitive swimmer, I think that's a fascinating scholarship. That's a topic all for itself. Did you know that you were going to go into the armed services, and did you pick the Marines out of the other options that were available?
Yeah, I did. Actually, it was the campus protest that kind of convinced me I was going to go in. There were just a lot of people kind of turning their back on the country, and I said, I'm not going to be one of them. So whatever I thought of the war, I was going to go.
Wow.
And I chose the Corps simply because I could still do that as opposed to go the ROTC way and get commissioned. So I went to Quantico, Virginia for 12 fun-filled weeks between my junior and senior year, and after the day I graduated, it pinned on my bars.
Wow, that's – well, I guess – I mean, there's no time like the present. Let's get you going. So when you got through basic training and got your first assignment, where did you end up? And how soon after that did writing – if you know, I'm assuming that came into play for where you were at. How soon did that jump into your career in the Marines?
Well, it actually had, interestingly enough, very little to do with it, although I did spend a lot of time writing operations plans and that kind of stuff. My first tour was in Southeast Asia, predictably. The war was still going on. And I did some writing. I'd done some throughout my childhood, but predictably it wasn't all that great. I didn't have much in the way of training, and I didn't have a whole lot in the way of life experiences. The Corps kind of took care of that for me because over the next 22 years, I had a lot of time to experience different cultures and different people.
In those 22 years, did you ever have an assignment, Dirk, that you took that was, you know, like one of these top secret or, you know, missions that you can't really talk about? And if you can't talk about it, that's okay too. But
well, I did spend some time working in the special operations community. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll leave that.
We'll
answer
just leave
right
it at
there.
That.
Okay. So after you got out of the Marines, why did you pick 22 years as your magic service date?
There wasn't anything magical about it. I just reached a point where I said, you know what, I've done about everything that I can conceivably do in this MOS. So as a logistician, which is what I was towards the end of my career. So I just said, you know what, it's time to move on and try a new challenge.
So when you got out of the service, did you know that you were going to take that 18-month sabbatical? Or was that?
Actually, no. I thought, well, gee, I've got all this transferable skill
sure.
that I can use in corporate America, and I found out that at that particular time, because the economy was kind of in a slide, there weren't many people hiring. So I said, semper gumby, always flexible. Why don't I just go get a master's degree while I wait for the economy to turn around?
Now, did you grow up in Southern California, or is this a new landing post for you?
No, I grew up in the Midwest, and
I'm sorry, that's right. How did you get here?
Well, I got stationed repeatedly at Camp Pendleton down in just north of Oceanside.
Well, that would be a tough place to get stationed.
Oh, it's terrible, just terrible. Throw me in that briar patch.
Sure. So, When you got out of your master's program, had the economy turned around at that point? Did you find it easier to go out? Okay.
It was less than a month. In fact, I just finished defending my thesis and saw a job that I wanted to apply for, went, interviewed, wound up getting hired as a corporate trainer, and spent the next 11 years there.
Goodness. So when you go into something that is, I mean, arguably very different than something like the Marine Corps, and you're in corporate training, did you end up having any type of culture shock from your end, having any type of adjustments in the workplace, or was it like,
sure.
Hey, this is just the newest, okay.
Sure. One of the first things that I found out was the euphemisms that I used out of habit from having been in the Corps for so long, most people look at me funny and say, what are you talking about? So I had to find a way to kind of exercise all of those things from my vocabulary because I was using them all the time, and people were looking at me funny and wondering what planet I was from.
Now, as a corporate trainer, is that something that you I don't say enjoyed, but I guess that would be the question. I mean, you stuck with it for quite some time. Was that something that you know, relished doing? How much of a growth did you have after you took that type of a role?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah.
I had several different curricula that I taught and managed. Some of them were it was a managerial curriculum that we had. Also had a curriculum specifically for sales and product knowledge, and so I had a lot of different curriculums to manage, and it just never got boring. So
now were you writing any of your short stories or working on any of your book ideas at this time, or is this something?
Yeah,
that...
by then I had started. I actually began towards the tail end of my. My career there in this organization, which also remained nameless,
okay.
I was actually working on West of Tomorrow then.
And then, so how did you come up with that idea? Did any of is any of West of Tomorrow maybe a little autobiographical?
Well, I sort of yes, in the sense that a lot of the experience the protagonist Clay Conover has. Were experiences that I had. That said, I've done what every author does, and I've taken extensive literary license, if you will.
Sure.
So no one in that book is an absolute analog for anyone that I knew in real life. So,
how long did it take you to write the book?
No, I'm ashamed to say it took me almost 6 years.
Well, I mean, you know, no, but you know that I have authors that, you know, it takes decades, and just, you know, they would write and put it down and come back years later and, you know, write and put it down. So when you started the book to the end of the book, did you have any type of through line that you knew that was, you know, I'm starting here and I'm going to end at this place, or was it, you know, just kind of organic?
This one was mostly organic, which was part of why it took so darn long. I kind of had an idea in my mind that I wanted to, if you will, paint for the reader a picture of what it's like to go through the transition process and what it's like in corporate America for somebody who's still really kind of not entirely civilianized, and some of the problems that pop up as you go through the experience. You're not sensitized to the politics of corporate America the way you were the politics you have in the military.
Well, and one of the things that you were sharing with me before our talk tonight was that your character in the book Clay, he goes through quite a spiritual growth from, you know, the beginning to the end. Can you tell us a little bit about who Clay is as a character and
sure.
and what some of the trials are that he endures?
Yeah, Clay Conover is one of those individuals who carries a lot of ghosts around with him. Some of them are associated with directly with his military experiences. Others are kind of spinoffs of being in the military, but they're actually related to family and the personal issues that often surround that lifestyle, because of course, as you probably know, divorce rates are high in the military.
Sure.
There's a lot of daddy's going away for the fifth time in 10 years, and where are you going this time kind of thing. So your children often grow up while you're somewhere else, and that often weighs on the father, the absentee father, over the course of those years. So, and Clay has that problem going on. So
I'm going to throw this back at you then. Did you have those similar issues with family while you were on all of your tours?
Sure.
Did you,
sure.
How does that make you feel, you know, either, you know, going away, but then coming home and then seeing, you know, these little babies that were babies now all of a sudden are grown up?
What you find yourself doing when you do that repeatedly is both sides of the equation kind of learn how to do it, but the process, it's really as much a matter of going through the motions, and there's an awful lot that happens beneath the surface that never really comes up. So you wind up there's a lot of suppressed emotion that just kind of never boils out, and it comes up. It may come up at inconvenient times. It may never come up. It may come back to haunt you years later.
Do people in the service go through any type of like family counseling or kind of like a reintroduction into the family unit after you guys get back, or is it just kind of left on your own that we're going to cross our fingers and hope for the best?
We're getting better and better at that. In the 70s and the 80s, when I spent most of my time in the military, the answer was pretty much no. First tour enlisted folks got some, return from overseas counseling, and you could always get it if you asked for it. But all that said, the resources were never equal to the demand.
Yeah, and as, let's face it, everybody in the service, they're rough and tough and hard to bluff, but as a Marine, I would think you're extra special and rough and tough and hard to bluff. Would it affect, would it affect how many people would actually try to seek out any type of counseling or help, because, we're macho and, we don't want to really, let anybody know that we have feelings?
I suspect that dynamic goes on, but I think more than anything else, after your second or third tour, you think, I've got this wired, or if I don't, I should have.
Right. Wow. I can't even imagine what that must be like. Do you have, out of all your tours that you can talk about, so we're not going to ask you about anything that you can't talk about, did you have one of your tours that was a favorite for you?
Oh, boy. actually, my favorite tour was not overseas. It was a tour that I had down at Pendleton as the Assistant Division Maintenance Management Officer, and I just loved that job because of the people that I was working with. Overseas, probably it was the last one, because I spent an awful lot of time working with the Koreans, the Japanese, the Thai, it was just, I was constantly on an aircraft going somewhere to work with somebody doing something, whether it was humanitarian relief or whether it was just kind of teaching them how to do something they didn't do so pretty good.
Oh, my word. I mean, what a thrill that must be to know that, whatever you're doing in these different, places, you're really there making a difference that's going to positively impact their lives for generations to come. Did you make any, lasting friends in these fantastic places that you went to?
Unfortunately, because of often the different career paths that we had, nothing that's endured.
Well, that's an interesting answer, because you wouldn't think that you're going to make lasting friends over there, but Who knows? Things happen. Anyhow, I could ask you about your Marine career all night long. So let's get back to writing, because that's really what you're here for. And I'm sorry, Dirk.
Sure.
So we've got this book, West of Tomorrow. When you came up with the idea of starting this book, did you have a specific time that you would sit down and say, okay, I'm going to spend an hour today writing? Or did you have a concept in your mind how you're going to map out your writing process?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Most of the writing that I did on West of Tomorrow, I did before work started.
Okay.
I would get into the office an hour to an hour and a half early, bring my laptop with me, and I'd do some work on that. During that period, I knew I was going to get calls early in my morning from some of the time zones further east, and I could usually slide a good 45 minutes to an hour writing in between phone calls while I was fielding questions from folks who were in the central or mountain or eastern time zones. So I do that pretty much every day that I didn't have some place I absolutely had to be first thing in the morning. And then I wrote over the weekends.
I think that's the most unique answer I've ever had an author give, saying that they took their laptop to work and they did it. That's absolutely brilliant. And that's a great way to beat the rush hour traffic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, great. So when I was going to say, do you have a favorite place to write? Well, you wrote at the office. When you're at home, did you find a way to really create an environment that was easier for you to be creative and spend that time writing?
I didn't really do anything to the environment. The environment for me is my state of mind and what I'm attempting to do, at least in my head. So I'm pretty much comfortable wherever. I can also write on the road if I have to. It's not always easy to do, but I've been known to write in a coffee shop.
Well, now, as a writer, I know you said that you had the laptop. Have you always been a laptop writer, or have you ever dabbled
Yes.
with a pen and paper? Okay.
Now, I always use a word processing program. Word's my weapon of choice right now. But and it's simply easier from the perspective both of formatting and obviously revision, because you're not feeding a lot of paper through that sucker.
Absolutely. So when you get, obviously you've read a couple of books over the years, as one does.
Sure.
As a reader, before you got ready to start writing your book, West of Tomorrow, what are elements of plot stories that you've read that you say, you know what, boy, this really makes this something I can't put down?
For me, a really well-written story is going to the character is going to grab you from the beginning.
Okay.
Almost all, to me anyway, all stories that work really well and work consistently throughout the course of the story are driven by the character. What is he or she going through? Where is he or she right now? And what log jams are going to get thrown in their way, and how are they going to navigate them, or in some cases not navigate them? But it's for me, it starts with character, and then it's a storyline that takes you logically, or at least believably, through the arc of that protagonist's journey.
Did you give yourself?
So that could be anything.
Well, okay. And when you sat down to do this, and we have Clay as the main character, did you give yourself any type of either limit or timeline on how many people you would allow to be characters within the book?
I had in my mind that there was going to be Clay, there was going to be an antagonist, and he was going to have a relationship with a daughter that was at the time living in the general area. And the rest, I kind of, the story suggested who else had to be in there. And as the story unfolded, I found a couple of characters that I really liked as I drew character sketches for them and started fleshing out who they were three-dimensionally. And I kind of turned a couple of them into spokespersons. So often there are a couple of characters in the book that when they speak, they're really kind of speaking for the author.
Well, that's great because, you know, it's a great tool for you to share your message as we go out here. When you are creating these characters, and I know you said they're an amalgam of, you know, lots of different people, so there's nobody in particular that it you know, it's really pinning on. Did you find yourself using, different events that actually took place, or did you kind of, you know, fudge those as well as in the reality that you're creating in the book?
Both.
Oh, okay.
Some of the events and the situations I had an opportunity to experience to some degree. So I didn't have to do as much, well, how would he or she really feel about that? Because I kind of saw it unfold.
Mm-hmm.
But others were literally made out of whole cloth and are complete fabrications. So I heard someone say a while ago, in order to be a great author, you have to be a great liar. So I told some, it's professional lying for all intents and purposes.
Sure, sure. So when you were putting this all together, did you have a main goal in mind, Dirk, when you sat down with your first, you know, laptop and wrote out the first sentence of the book?
Yes. I actually had several. I had in mind a number of thematic elements that I wanted to bring out, and like most authors, I kind of hate to summarize reductively, but I wanted to tell a story about a recareered Marine officer who, because of the experiences that he'd had in the military, had this really strong sense of organizational loyalty that blinded him to an impending power play that was going to pop up in his organization. And that blindness ultimately results in him losing his job. And this by itself dislocating event is actually preceded by the death of a best friend and a couple of other personal issues that he's had to deal with from a family perspective. So his world's kind of all crumbled around him. And to add insult to injury, the hatchet man on his being fired is actually a girlfriend who's also a work compadre who he trained.
Oh, of course. As often happens.
Yeah, so he's kind of had the carpet jerked out from under him. And so a way of looking at it thematically is there's corporate intrigue, there's misplaced love in here, and as the story unfolds, we get to what real love maybe looks like, at least for Clay, and what his particular process of self-reinvention looks like as the story unfolds.
Well, and I think this is now a perfect time, everybody, to take a little commercial break, as we say in the business. We're going to take a listen to It Matters Radio and then also our friends at Rainbow Brew. We're going to come back and talk more with Dirk Sayers, author of West Up Tomorrow, if I can read my screen correctly. For everybody who's listening tonight, I've also got a link to go buy Dirk's book on Amazon. It says buy Dirk's book on Amazon here. Click the here button. It will take you right there. You can make the purchase tonight. We're going to be back in 2 minutes and 30 seconds, so go run and get a cup of coffee, get a cup of tea, or run to the bathroom, whatever you need to do. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
Well, first of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
Aye, wonderful people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, a duff man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, Letty, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be...
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
That's a mouthful if I ever heard one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
Everybody, we are joined by Mr. Dirk Sayers. He's the author of West of Tomorrow. There's a link on the show page for you to go click and buy it tonight on Amazon. We'll always ask you to support our artists that are on the show. But before we get back to Dirk, I want to give some special shout-outs to Tony in Hackensack. We've got Wesley in Fayetteville. Scott is in Cleveland. I've got Robert down in Costa Mesa. Victoria is in Newport. Sheena's up in Hollywood. RJ's normally here in California. He's listening live from London. I don't know why you're not in bed. Clara is in Lima, Peru. Eric is in Mesa, Arizona. JC's up in Hollywood. David's in Hollywood. Charlotte's in Charlotte, you're up in the LA area someplace. Sorry, I don't have that listed. And Tony's up in Hollywood. And everybody else is pinging me. Thank you very much for tuning in tonight. It's always a pleasure to have you here. We're joined again by Dirk Sayers, author of West of Tomorrow. Before the break, we were talking about, you know, the writing process and all of this. But one thing that I would love to know from a, you know, like a greedy, self-fulfilling standpoint, what does writing do for you, Dirk? What do you get out of telling your stories?
Yeah. I don't know that I can stop writing. I'm one of those people you press play and it just kind of starts. It goes and it goes, and so it's for me it's a way of kind of framing not only what I'm thinking, but it's a way of kind of framing the world. I wax philosophical sometimes when I write. And it's almost a way of carrying on a conversation with the universe. So
kind of. Your first book here, you know, it's a, you know, like a current day tale of office intrigue and romance and things like that. But you're now branching off, as I understand it, into science fiction. How do you go from corporate America to outer space?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'm not sure I have a better answer than I just had this thought one day, and I said, what if? I used to have this dream as a kid, and I was floating over this kind of sea of silver gray with a bunch of lights beneath it, and I had no control over where I went. And I kept wanting to go one way, and I kept going a different way. And this kind of became the crystal for the opening of what's has turned into Tier Zero, the first volume of the Nolan cycle. It's going to be a science fiction series about First Contact. When the story opens, First Contact has already occurred 30 years ago, in fact, and not a living, breathing Earth human is aware of it. That, however, is about to change. with far-reaching consequences, but those far-reaching consequences actually don't occur on Earth. And you kind of have to read the story for it to make any sense. But it's even difficult to decipher at first why the Nolans have any interest whatsoever in Earth, or Curaçao, as they call it. But it's going to be, I think, at least three volumes. It may be four. It kind of depends on how volume two goes. But I'm pretty close to the end of volume one. I go through a review process with an author group that I sponsor, and they've been through all of the chapters so far, and we're pretty close to wrapping it up. So once that's done, it'll go to an editor, and we'll find out whether it's worth anything.
We always hope it is, because
that's the truth.
We tell these stories. So for this book, now you said you take it to an author group that you sponsor, and then it goes off to the editor. When you wrote your first book, were you surprised at the amount of bleeding that took place on the pages, or were you fairly unscathed when you got your first draft back?
No. I am blessed with an author's group that kind of doesn't pull many punches. It's not for the faint of heart.
Okay.
They will look you straight in the eye and tell you what they think. And if they love it, great. And if they don't, they let you know. The great thing about it, though, is everybody in that group, and it's a small, fairly tight-knit group. It's been together quite a while now. But everybody is in it for the others as well as themselves. So once you get the notion that, look, what we're trying to accomplish here is to make all of us better. While it may sting, it's good for your ultimate growth. So you just kind of roll with it, and we always take the suggestions that work for us, and if we're still wedded to whatever our artistic vision might be at the time, we just ignore them.
So, let me ask you this then. As you're toughening up in the Marines and your career and the military and then your corporate career, did you have a pretty good shell of protection around you when you would receive criticism? Or how open are you to saying, you know what, I'm an open book, you know, so, pardon the pun, but, you know, just lay it on me.
No, I don't think most authors go into that sort of thing initially with much of a shell on them, because when you write, if you're really writing from your soul, you're bearing yourself.
Sure.
There is no armor. So what you're doing, if you're being authentic, is you're exposing yourself to them, and that can be pretty hard on you. You just have to kind of know that going in.
Well, at least from your experience, what would be one of your biggest challenges that you find as a writer as a recurring challenge for you? So, you know, it's happened on the book, it's happened on your articles, your short stories. You know, what might that be for you, if you have one?
Oh, yeah. I have a tendency to want to write too much.
Isn't that better?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that better?
The good news, if you write too much, is you can always edit it down.
Right.
But it's sometimes difficult to look at that if it starts out at 99,000 words, to look at those 99,000 words and say, okay, this clump here needs to go away, and that clump here needs to go away, because you wrote it, for God's sake, and you know you're now wedded to that darn thing. So it takes a little practice to stuff your ego in your hip pocket and say, okay, you know what, if it's not working for anybody in this group, it probably needs to go away.
So, I mean, because, you know, when you sit down and write these words, you have to think, when they're coming out of your fingertips, these are the most eloquent words ever to be recorded in the history of the universe. Everybody is going to love this. And then like they come back with that feedback and say, okay, you got 99,000, get it down to 70.
Yeah. Well,
where do you go to?
What usually the way it works is because we do it chapter at a time.
Sure.
I'll get notations. This isn't working, and this isn't working, and I don't know what you mean by this. And so the reductive effect that has over time is it whittles what was 99,000 or 91,000 or whatever it was words down to whatever it winds up being. The objective, of course, is to have a story that kind of moves forward. And if you start dwelling on stuff, as I am sometimes inclined to do, somebody needs to reach out and smack you and say, okay, move along, tell the story.
Do you, as a reader yourself, and, you know, because, again, you read voraciously, I'm sure, just through the course of history, what irritates you about books? And especially now that you've written a book and you go, well, boy, I had to go through this vetting process, and, you know, we really talked about this in my writer's group, and somebody sure didn't get this benefit because, boy, this novel's terrible.
Yeah.
You know, what irritates you?
It depends on the genre, but the ones that really, as you were saying that, jump into my mind are books where the technical part clearly isn't right. You either because you know better or because mm-hmm. you say that doesn't sound right, and you look it up and you say, well, it isn't right,
and it's not right.
Yeah. So for me, that's probably the most annoying thing. The other thing maybe is, I having a hard time believing this particular aspect in this character. And you'll see it in film, you'll see it in books, you know. I can't square what they did here with what they did back there earlier.
Now, then let me ask you this, because, you know, you have your current day, you know, corporate intrigue novel that you have, and now you're going into science fiction. Do you find that you have to have a different standard for your character's suspension of disbelief, or, you know, carrying through, you know, so you can have that leap of faith that, yes, they are going to do these particular actions? The first one did it in corporate America, and now we've got the, you know, the mm-hmm. hero or heroine doing it in outer space.
Sure. You have to construct a world in which this particular race, the Edarans, for example, or the Valdrosians or the Nolans, behave this way. They physically look like this. Their genetics and their biostructure is such that they behave in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably, in fact, in almost all cases, is fundamentally different than we would. Then there's the technical part. Well, okay, how did they master space travel?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those speculative things that you can use a little bit of fairy dust, I think.
Sure.
But the fairy dust has to make sense, and it has to be logically consistent. So it can't work for one group, and it doesn't work for another.
Right. Yeah. And, yeah, I think, you know, that's a perfect example, because you do find things every once in a while that kind of slip through the cracks, especially in pictures, those moving pictures, they see it, that Cineplex thing. But, you know, you go and watch these movies and you're like, this doesn't make any sense at all. How in the world did this make it onto the screen? Didn't they have anybody editing or screening this ahead of time to let them know that this is totally ridiculous? So as a writer, you have your book out now. Did you take writing courses at any point, you know, go back to college outside of your master's degree for, you know, writing a novel?
I actually did that while I was still in college the first time around, and there was just this long hiatus while I was in the Corps where I wrote some, but I really never tried to get published other than professionally. But after that, no, actually I just wrote and revised a lot.
Okay. What was your first thing that you had published?
It was The Woman's No Fear Guide to Online Dating, which is actually a nonfiction book. But
is it okay if we talk about that?
Sure.
How do you write The Woman's No Fear Guide to Online Dating? You're a man.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I wrote it. I got into online dating early.
Okay.
Back when it was when it wasn't cool, you know. And I discovered that over a period of time, women were making the same mistakes as I suspect is equally true of men.
Sure, yeah.
But I was looking at their profiles and saying, wow, you know, she's an attractive woman. And just looking at the factual portions of her profile, sounds like someone I want to know. And then she says something down there in her little essay that makes me go, oh, man.
Oh,
no,
man.
No, 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 don't do that. So I just kind of started writing, and the next thing I knew, I had like 8 or 9 chapters, and I said, well, yeah, maybe there's a market for it. So I went ahead and published the darn thing, and I think I was a day late and a dollar short. It didn't sell particularly well, but the people who did read it found it enlightening. I just learned that it's a lot harder to get yourself up above the horizon where you can be noticed than I'd anticipated.
So let me ask you this. You wrote that first book, and you said then I went and had it published. Did you self-publish?
Yes, I did.
You did. Now, why did you choose to do that versus trying to beat your head against a brick wall and have Random House publish it?
Well, precisely because you're beating your head against a wall when you try to get Random House to publish it. The practical realities of publishing today in the 21st century in the United States and probably around the world is that there's just not enough bandwidth, and because of the margins that the publishing houses have to deal with these days, they just can't publish everything that that they might like to. And particularly something like The Woman's No Fear Guide to Online Dating, it's kind of perishable information anyway. In fact, you go back to read it now. I published it 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt a lot of it other than the philosophy is of much value, because the sites have changed and the way they operate have changed. So it's perishable information. So just to get it out, I went ahead and self-published.
So in the business of writing books, you're just talking about how the industry has changed. It's not 1976, and you've got, you know, zero options out there if you're just this indie writer out there. Mm-hmm. How do you approach selling yourself and selling your material as an indie writer?
Yeah, with great difficulty. You have to think of yourself as kind of an entrepreneur, and you look at it from the perspective of, I'm trying to do this for, you know, maybe personal reasons as well, but in order for it to be successful commercially, I have to figure out who I'm writing for. I have to figure out if there's still a market for it or is it already flooded. And there are a whole series of questions you have to ask and answer in order to get to a place where you even plausibly have a shot at making it work. Then it's just a matter of education, because you can do it yourself. There are all kinds of resources available now for somebody who wants to do independent publishing.
Now, did you ever get to a point where you're thinking about, boy, I need to do a crowdfunding thing to help make this miracle come true? Or
I've thought about it. I've never really tried to do it because it's just for me. It's I like to be able to do it on my own schedule and in my own way. And crowdfunding it, there are obviously expectations that the supporters would have. So I just kind of do it at my own pace and do it my way.
I love that. I mean, and I don't think there's a wrong answer. Whatever answer you have, it has to be the right answer for you in your particular mm-hmm. situation. So, you know, I've had people who've been on the show who've done crowdfunding. I've had people that said exactly what you've done, but that's what's worked for them. What about marketing? Now, I know that you have your Amazon page up, and again, everybody needs to go to Amazon tonight and buy West of Tomorrow. Again, support the cause. But outside of, you know, doing Amazon, how do you sell yourself to the world?
Well, the key is going to be blog tours and getting more reviews, clearly the more reviews you get, and as long as they're decent reviews,
yeah.
the better you're going to do, and the sales process will actually push you up to where you can be seen. I rarely go anywhere without business cards these days, and be careful what you ask me, because I'm sure to wicker it around in my book if you let me. So you just have to push yourself out there, and if that's really hard for a lot of writers, because we tend to be introverted in the first place. That's probably why we started writing instead of just yakking.
Well, I was just going to ask you that, because you know, I think that's the number one concern for writers that are out there. Is like, I love writing my book, but man, after I'm done writing, I have to actually go out and talk to people and sell it, and mm-hmm. you know how uncomfortable that makes me.
Yeah, like, that's the hard work. You have to go around to independent bookstores and say, "Hey, I have this book, and it's, I really think it's good, but you know, would you like to consign it, or you know, however you want to approach it, because you're not gonna get into Barnes and Noble."
Right.
So you have to go to an independent bookstore, and there are a lot of them around. So it's just literally shoe leather, phone calls, all that kind of stuff.
Do you have a time that you set aside each day or each week? I find that if I don't time block whatever I need to do, it absolutely does not get done. Do you set specific goals for yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I'm one of these people who still has a paper day timer, and that's how I allocate my time for that sort of thing. And
so
you're right, you block it out. I'm going to do social media. I'm going to write a blog post for my website. I'm going to yada yada yada. I'm going to make some calls. I'm going to go see if I'm going to head to Laguna Beach today and talk to the independent bookstore down there on Forest Avenue and da 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 da.
And then hopefully get a few yeses along the way. Okay,
yeah.
So I'm going to call you a resident of Southern California for a big chunk of your life now. Are you finding it easier to get into these independent bookstores, or finding audiences that are receptive to, you know, hearing you talk?
Well, it kind of depends. I've just published West of Tomorrow, so I haven't really tried to push that one yet too much. I published it in December. But I think the answer is it's going to depend on the bookstore. You really kind of need to go in there and say, okay, what are they carrying? You know, if you walk into a bookstore that is just chock full of, And I don't mean any of this disparagingly, but they've got romance novels and they've got, genre fiction that is probably geared to a different crowd. If you walk in there with West of Tomorrow, it's not going to, they're for not being mean, they're just going to look at you and say, sorry, we don't do that stuff.
Right, right.
So you kind of have to pick your audiences, and you're going to find, if you work cross genre, you won't be going to the same list of bookstores, for example, simply because they want different things.
So as we get ready to wrap up our time together here, Dirk, do you have advice? Well, I need to back up. I'm going to ask you the advice question last. Where would you like people to become fans of yours on social media? Where do you like to connect with your people?
I do have a website, dirksayers.com. By all means, hit me up on my Twitter feed at Dirk Sayers. I have a Facebook fan page. Any of those will work.
And so we all need to go do that. And then, Dirk, as far as advice for other budding writers, I know you're part of a writer's group, you know, mm-hmm. Maddie, and you go to Lit Up, and you're doing all these fun things. But for people who are listening tonight from either in the area or from around the country or around the world, what would you tell them if they are sitting at home going, you know, I know I've got the next great story, but I just don't mm-hmm. know what to do? What words of advice would you give to people tonight?
Well, you just said the first one, write a great story. You can't sell a bad story. I would start with a great story that has a good story arc to it, nuanced characters, has some really good, relevant, underpinning themes. Join an author's group, get your work at it, and don't settle for superficial writing. Even genre fiction can and should have thoughtful themes woven into them. That gives the reader more than just a memorable story. It gives them something to chew on, to think about, and something that, you know, ostensibly could they can carry with them the rest of their lives. I know I've read books that that came in that fall in that category. So that'd be my advice for authors. And for readers, you know, watch less TV, read more, and find writers that make you think a little bit. It's good for us all.
That's great advice. Yeah. Everybody, it's been Mr. Dirk Sayers. His book is West of Tomorrow. It's available on Amazon now. Click the link. Buy it tonight. We will be back tomorrow night with Rated LGBT Radio with Rob Watson and our special guest, Terrence Moss of Child of the 70s. And again, go out and support all of your favorite independent artists around the country and around the world wherever you can. This is a little Sweat and Testify by me. This is my latest single. If you like it, give it a thumbs up on Hottest New Artist. It's been number one for 8 weeks in a row, hopefully another 8 to come. And we'll see you live tomorrow night, everybody. Have a great evening, and don't drive distracted.
Slapping your lips like your house is on fire. I can't save you like a Sunday school choir. Saying too much like an auctioneer's chant.
Yeah. You've been listening to
Rated G Radio.